Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Why do they need to be in more than one region in the United States? Because they're devastating western states right now. This kind of brings analogy to me like, well, there's plenty of giraffes in Africa, but there's no giraffes in Northern America. So therefore, we must have an endangered giraffe species in Northern America.
California Representative Doug LaMalfa at a recent hearing on the Endangered Species Act.
Well, I think that you do want to have multiple populations to be resilient if something were to happen to some subpopulation. However, that does not mean that they need to inhabit their entire historic range. Right now, one of the criticisms about wolves is that they occur in about 20% of their historic range in the United States, which is similar to elk. Elk occur in about 20% of their historic range in the United States, and I don't think anybody would argue that elk are endangered.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
When you get this high, you start to get tension, start to get high, nerves start to get high, and I think we're seeing that play out.
Referring to the cattle markets, Arlen Suderman with StoneX.
Earlier this week, we saw a lot of pressure hit the market as consumer confidence really plummeted. And consumer confidence is critical for the beef industry, for the consumer to be willing to pay up for the higher cuts of meat. But then we start seeing the packers push the product prices higher, and the cash market last week was much stronger than anticipated. The expectation was that it would be notably lower this week. At least that was kind of the fear. But as we got into today's trade, we started hearing word from the country that maybe those cash prices will be lower this week, but looks like not as low, much lower as what we anticipated, that the market's holding better than expected. Now, we had the big $8 plus gains in choice a couple of days ago. Yesterday, we followed that up with some more gains in choice. This morning, choice cuts were a little bit lower, but select was solidly higher. So the product market is hanging in there right now. And I think that's helping firm those ideas a little bit on the cash market and why the board was back into positive territory once again today, reaching up there in our highest close, it looks like. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, Tony, but I believe that's the highest close on record for the April contract.
And while cattle make new all-time highs, so does the gold market.
Yeah, I would call gold in this case our uncertainty indicator. The great amount of uncertainty that's in the economy right now. And so a lot of investors and central banks moving to own gold. And even it's pulling silver up there to record values as well, or trying to, well, at least recent, I'd have to go back and look and see if the big sugar squeeze, I can't remember now, silver squeeze, if we spiked higher at that point, but new highs for that market as well. And it comes down to the uncertainty. If you look at next week and its tariff announcements next week, the market is very nervous about that. Now, the equity market was under pressure, modest pressure today. But overall, these markets, so I'm talking the broader markets now, have largely priced in a value that they feel comfortable taking into next week. But where do we go from there? What kind of tariff announcements are we going to get on April 2nd next week? What kind of retaliatory actions are we going to get from our trading partners next week? That's the uncertainty that the market's trying to price in. And that uncertainty is driving a lot of people right now toward the gold market, toward the hard assets, I should say. And gold is kind of the poster child for the hard assets.
Obviously, headlines will have tariffs and trade, but Suderman says keep an eye on the ports.
And I think the next big item to figure out is the port fees of up to $1 million, up to $1.5 million, depending on if it's a Chinese flagship or if it's just a Chinese-built ship or if it's a ship coming into port that is part of a fleet that is made up of Chinese ships. The Chinese ships make up about 55% of the world fleet. That's actually a much bigger deal than the tariffs, but we don't have a lot of clarity on it. My bias is that we're going to see a more pragmatic response than what's been initially announced. But if we don't, it has the potential to have a much bigger impact than tariffs on our overall export program. So I think that's the next thing that's going to hang over this market until we have more certainty there.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
USDA NASS released the Cattle on Feed report.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is Kansas State Livestock Economist.
March 1st, inventory was down 2%. That was pretty much on par with expectations, so no surprise there. When we look at the February data, we do get one surprise, or I'd call it a surprise, is February placements were down 18%, and they were kind of expected. The pre-report average was down 16%. So I want to pause on that one and break it down for a moment. Was the trade was definitely expecting February placements to be down. Part of that is days of the month. Some of that also was the disruption towards the end of 2024 on flow from Mexico into the U.S., particularly for southern yards, so Texas yards even more narrowly. We are expecting some months here early in 2025 to have fewer placements because the, at a minimum, the timing, the flows of animals that were coming from Mexico has been disrupted. I'm interjecting that because over the next few months, it will be interesting to watch, particularly the Texas part of this report, is do we sort of make up for and catch up on that? So were those flows simply changed in timing or is it an aggregate reduction? We don't know yet. It's probably somewhere between those two extreme statements. Probably a reduction, but not as much as it looks like. That's the point. But regardless, the February placement number being lower is another signal that upcoming supplies might be tighter than even we were expecting. And then February marketings came in about 9% below the prior year, roughly on par with 8% was what was expected, a reduction. But again, the fact that it was down a little bit more means we may have produced a little bit less beef than we expected. And again, my comment earlier on the supply side with the boxed beef, I think you can see how these are kind of adding up a little bit is we know we have a tight supply. Maybe it's a little tighter than we even thought. And then we're going to talk beef demand in a minute. But the supply tightness part of this story, I think in recent weeks, has definitely been what's underpinning the strength in the cattle and the boxed beef market.
And focuses on feedlot returns.
Our feedlot returns, I call it barometer, so it's just trends in profitability, net margins that are expected. And I want to give a shout-out, as I always do, to the Animal Science and Industries Department. I use the Focus on Feedlot Survey data for that. So lots of the in-weight, out-weight placements info, and then I married up with Kansas Market, so fed cattle, feeder cattle, and corn data, to come up with historic returns and forward-looking returns. The part that people most like to look at is the forward-looking part, which is what you're asking me about. And we last released these on March 19th, so they're fairly fresh, consistent with the market. Positive returns are projected now through Labor Day is the punchline. Just to give an example, you know, you and I are talking here in March. Closeouts here in March are projected to be plus $229. The way you interpret that in this report is each steer that leaves Kansas and that fits this scenario in March should have a positive return of $229. That presumes they weren't hedged, that you didn't hedge before the animal was bought, and you didn't hedge grain as you went. So it's kind of a no-risk management situation that's being modeled. Those returns are expected to stay north of $100 and actually north of $200 in a few of those months until we get out to about September, and that's plus $27. And they are actually projected to turn negative in October and November when we're not expected to have quite as high fed cattle prices, but the much higher feeder cattle prices have caught up with us and put that margin squeeze in place.
He also heads up the meat demand monitor.
Mixed bag would be my summary for the report in February. Remember, the meat demand monitor, everything's on our Ag Manager website. We put out these base monthly reports. When we look at February specifically, the retail demand data pointed to some weakness. So we saw a decrease compared to the month before on 6 of the 8 categories that we track. I will interject, however, that when you look back to the February of 2024, so instead of month over month, we look year over year for a moment, February of 25 actually had higher beef, pork, and chicken retail demand than we had in 24. And that's important because we ended 2024 with a good demand story. On balance, that has continued. I'm going to play my hand in a minute why I'm concerned and that we can't take it for granted. But we saw some month-over-month reductions, but importantly, we still have year-over-year growth in retail demand per this measure.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
As we work to develop and enact an on-time, multi-year surface bill.
At a recent House Transportation Subcommittee on Highways hearing, looking at trucking, David Rouser, representative from North Carolina, chairman of the subcommittee.
At our previous hearings, we received testimony on the importance of this subcommittee's programs to the American trucking industry, which has an instrumental role in the safe and efficient movement of goods across the highway system to each and every one of our communities. Today's hearing further examines these programs and their impacts with a specific focus on our motor carriers. As a predominant users of the highway system, the trucking industry moved nearly two-thirds of all goods into our communities in 2023. That's 12.9 billion freight tons worth an estimated $13.56 trillion. In fact, 80% of communities across the country depend solely on trucks to receive their goods. More than likely, every member of this subcommittee represents a community that exclusively relies on trucking to stock their supermarket shelves, transport critical medicines to local pharmacies, and ensure retail stores have merchandise. In North Carolina, for example, 85.6% of communities are dependent on trucking. The industry supports one out of every 15 jobs across the state, and I'm grateful to those men and women who day in and day out take on the task of delivering for all North Carolinians. And this is true all over the country. The trucking workforce's commitment to delivering for North Carolinians was on full display last year when Hurricane Helene ripped through our state, devastating communities, wiping out homes, and killing more than 100 people. In the wake of the storm, truckers across the state and region, and across the country, quite frankly, rallied without hesitation to deliver much-needed aid to our friends and neighbors. The bottom line is that truckers deliver essential goods when disaster strikes and serve as a key partner in larger emergency coordination and relief efforts. While federal law provides for targeted regulatory relief from certain restrictions during those times, we will continue to explore ways to help improve disaster response outcomes. And despite the importance of trucking to our communities and the supply chain at large, challenges continue to plague the trucking industry and the men and women behind the wheel. I suspect our witnesses today and encourage our witnesses today to detail some of the broad challenges the industry faces, including growing and retaining the truck driver workforce, ensuring seamless compliance with federal, state, and local rules and regulations, and addressing rising costs associated with moving goods from point A to point B for both small and large operators. We have an opportunity in our surface bill to address such challenges in a smart and targeted manner while strengthening local communities and our economy. I look forward to working with my colleagues on the subcommittee to make it easier for women and men to choose this profession. And in so doing, we must explore ways to make it easier for individuals to train and test for a commercial driver's license, as well as build off the Safe Driver Apprenticeship Program established in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act to allow 18 to 20-year-old drivers to cross state lines. So we welcome, panel, your ideas about how to help the trucking industry continue to safely and efficiently deliver for all of our communities.
Chairman of the subcommittee and member of the House Ag Committee, David Rouser. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Soybeans, for the most part, each time they get down around $10, they start to uncover some demand, some buying interest. So we've gotten down into that territory.
Arlen Suderman is with StoneX, looks at the recent run-up in the soy complex and says it has long tentacles.
But then the spark that helped fuel things this morning was a wire service report that came out early this morning. And from our industry contacts, we can basically confirm it, indicating that the Trump administration asked the oil industry and the biofuel producer groups to work out a deal, to collaborate together and work out a deal on what they would recommend to be biofuel policy for the United States, and then come back and hopefully get back here by the end of the month and let the EPA then work out the details over the next 1 to 2 months in order to give us a policy. It's that lack of a policy that has severely hurt our crush margins, our crush demand here of late. We've seen liquid biomass diesel production drop by over 50% from December levels in January and February because we don't have a tax credit policy right now. And so it looks like the industry is moving toward an agreement. Looks like ethanol will be probably mandated around 15 billion gallons, but with support for transitioning toward E15. That doesn't mean an immediate 50% increase in consumption or demand, but it allows the industry to start ratcheting up both demand and production. The overall target for renewable diesel and diesel is currently at 3.35. It looks like the industry wants to raise it to at least 4.75 billion gallons and maybe as high as 5.5 billion gallons. Still some things to work out on the 45Z tax credit program. But the bottom line is we're seeing some movement here finally, and that led the market to assume what we're going to see increased demand for soy oil. Now, the way things work in Washington, we usually have some ups and some downs in policy development. So I wouldn't be surprised if a headline tomorrow kind of kills the enthusiasm, or maybe it's the day after, trading day after or whatever. But for today, the enthusiasm was there. The ironic thing is that soy oil prices were previously getting cheap enough and RIN values high enough that we were on the verge of starting to be where we could economically justify starting up some of the biodiesel plants and renewable diesel plants again that were shut down. But now the surge in soy oil prices has kind of kicked that down the road once again because today's economics don't work in the absence of that policy.
You might remember back in 2006 that President George W. Bush at the time floated an idea for ethanol using switchgrass. It's hard to believe that was 20 years ago.
EPA is still trying to push things in that direction. It's just the technology simply isn't there yet. But I think the encouraging thing is instead of fighting each other in court, we have the two sides working together. And one big difference from Trump 1.0 is the fossil fuel industry is heavily bought into the biofuel industry now. And so rather than opponents now, they have more in common than what they did a decade ago.
And this is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Everything we produce in this country goes through one of three channels. So domestic retail, grocery store for at home, domestic food service, so think restaurants, or export. And we're talking domestic, so those two other channels. But there is at times strength in one domestic market, not the other.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is a Kansas State livestock economist looking at the meat demand monitor.
We actually saw some strength in the food service channel in February. So willingness to pay for a dinner meal away from home was higher on 7 of the 8 categories we track. The ones that were weaker were plant-based patty, and that's not new. There's been some weakness there for some time. If that trend continues, and you probably picked up on my voice that, you know, it changed, is if underneath that is foot traffic going up, right, to sustain those higher willingness to pays for dinner meals away from home. I hope it continues. It was definitely something we watched 2023 and a good chunk of 2024 was as financial sentiment became bearish, if you like, in U.S. households. They were less likely to go to restaurants. It's really important as the broader macroeconomic uncertainty is facing the country, how that plays out on its own. But specifically for the meat industry, watching foot traffic through food service channel is going to be really important to watch. And it was nice to see the numbers up in February. But hopefully everybody heard me as like that's definitely one of the things I'm watching as March concludes and we move into April and so forth.
But the fact is proteins cost more. So is there a value proposition?
We have something called protein value. So it's a list of 12 things. And we ask, what are the 4 most important? What are the 4 least important when you make a protein purchasing decision? And we regularly see taste and freshness lead in that discussion. And we regularly see things like environmental impact and origin and traceability rank quite low. And what I mean by high and low is if I say it's high, you're very likely to tell me it's a top 4, very unlikely to tell me it's a bottom 4, and then the reverse on the bottom end of this. The thing I'll highlight that's a little different than the past is price always shows up as the 3rd or 4th most important. So it's always important consideration, but it's relative, and all these measures are relative. It's a forced rank. If you remember that, you have 12, you can only choose 4. So it's not everything is important in this exercise. Price has grown in importance since last year. And I'm going to interject that because my earlier comments about demand concerns, if you like, is the public, and we see a few things in the February meat demand monitor that point to the public getting increasingly concerned with inflation specifically. And if that's the case, the importance of price is going to grow in your relative importance, and we definitely need to watch that.
The willingness to pay more also comes along with consumer finances.
So we ask every month again is, are your finances better, the same, or worse than last year? You know, quick reminder, every month, over 3,000 people are filling this out now, so it's a nationally representative number I'm bringing to you. And in February, 20% said their finances are better than last year. Now, that's great for that group. We would just like to see that be 60, 80, 100%, right? And it's never 100%. Don't overreact to that comment, but we would like to see not be the minority. What's important for the meat industry is the group that says their finances are improving is way more likely to tell me they had beef, pork, or chicken yesterday. And that's not surprising, but we report the number of meals, you know, by breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and so forth. And all those numbers are quite higher if you tell me your finances are improving. The other thing we put at the end of the base report, and I kind of played my hand earlier on the inflation point, is we also ask folks, what are you expecting prices to be next month on four retail meat categories? And it's ribeye steak, ground beef, pork chops, and bacon. And at the end of the February report, you could pull up a chart, and there's purple bar charts for the February 2025. I'm giving the color cues for people to pull this up. You'll see those bars are taller. They're, you know, the numbers associated with those bars are larger in this February than they were February of 24 or February 23. What that means is for those two beef and those two pork categories is the public's expecting prices to increase more here in March, given what they were looking at in February, than when I asked them the same thing in 24 and 23.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The success of American agriculture relies on a robust, safe, and dependable transportation system. The products we grow and raise must travel far beyond our farm gates to reach markets, processors, and consumers.
Minnesota Farm Bureau President Dan Glassine at a House Transportation Subcommittee on Highways hearing looking at trucking issues.
That journey begins on rural roads and bridges, which serve as a critical first link in our transportation supply chain. That is why Congress needs to consider common sense solutions that address our supply chain shortfalls by streamlining the process for hiring truck drivers, expanding safe parking opportunities, increasing truck weights, and allowing easier transportation of commodities within 150 mile radius for drivers under the age of 21. A great example of the transportation policy on farmers all the way through the supply chain to the consumers has been highly pathogenic avian influenza, which has significantly impacted Minnesota poultry populations and diminished the national supply of eggs. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration issued an emergency declaration exempting hours of service regulations for commercial motor vehicle operations engaged in the emergency transport of live chickens. While this declaration was helpful, it can make an even greater point to the agricultural supply chain. The decisions that are made in this committee and regulatory burdens faced by agriculture have a direct impact on the price of food for consumers and the livelihood of farmers in Minnesota and across America. My testimony today will outline several key issues affecting our nation's agriculture industry and transportation infrastructure. The American Farm Bureau continues to support the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act for its essential investments in our nation's infrastructure. These investments will help keep U.S. agriculture competitive in the global market, which is all the more essential when, for the first time in many of our lifetimes, the U.S. has become a net food importer. Ensuring that our farmers and ranchers have access to reliable transportation infrastructure is more critical now than ever. The National Highway Trust Fund is the backbone of our transportation infrastructure, providing crucial funding for the maintenance and improvement of roads and bridges in rural communities. However, the fund faces long-term sustainability challenges. Farm Bureau supports increasing highway trust fund fees to reflect the advancements in fuel efficiency and rising inflation. We also advocate for ensuring that all road users, regardless of fuel source, contribute fairly to the fund's revenue. Investments in roads and bridges must not only address urban congestion, but also the unique needs of rural America. Over 46% of America's roads are rated as poor or mediocre, and over 10% of rural bridges are structurally deficient. When a bridge closure forces a farmer to take a 50-mile detour just to transport the grain to a local elevator, it's not just an inconvenience, it's a direct hit to their bottom line. I urge this committee work on the farm work with the Farm Bureau to prioritize long-term sustainable funding solutions for the National Highway Trust Fund. Transportation regulations must also take into account the unique needs of agriculture. We are transporting live animals, and every additional stop or delay poses a risk to the health and safety. The IIJA recognized this by providing an exemption for livestock and insect haulers from hours of service regulations within a 150-mile radius of their final destination. We appreciate this committee's work in securing that exemption, and we ask for continued support to ensure regulations reflect the realities of agricultural transportation. In closing, I urge this committee to prioritize the needs of rural America as you consider transportation infrastructure investments and regulatory policies. By maintaining strong rural road and bridge funding, ensuring fair contributions to the Highway Trust Fund, and upholding necessary exemptions for agricultural haulers, we can ensure a sustainable future for American agriculture.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The goal of the ESA is clear, to stop extinction and recover species. H.R. 1897, the ESA Amendment Act, doesn't do anything to improve outcomes for species and communities.
Representative Val Hoyle from Oregon at a recent Natural Resources Subcommittee hearing on the Endangered Species Act.
The Trump administration's actions make the recovery of these species even harder. For example, DOGE just cut key staff at NOAA who make ESA permitting efficient. We also lost experts who assess coastal impacts and work on recovering iconic species such as orcas or salmon. These specialists safeguard valuable species that keep our fisheries running, our communities fed. We're in a biodiversity crisis and need these core conservation laws to work. When species recover, everyone benefits.